Notes from the Underground by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Part 2, Chapter 8. It was some time, however, before I consented to recognize that truth, waking up in the morning after some hours of heavy, leaden sleep, and immediately realizing all that had happened on the previous day. I was positively amazed at my last night's sentimentality with Liza, at all those outcries of horror and pity. To think of having such an attack of womanish hysteria, pah, I concluded. And what did I thrust my address upon her for? What if she comes? Let her come, though, it doesn't matter. But obviously that was not now the chief and the most important matter. I had to make haste, and at all costs save my reputation in the eyes of Zverkov and Simonov as quickly as possible. That was the chief business, and I was so taken up that morning that I actually forgot all about Liza. First of all, I had at once to repay what I had borrowed the day before from Simonov. I resolved on a desperate measure to borrow 15 rubles straight off from Anton Antonich. As luck would have it, he was in the best of humors that morning, and gave it to me at once, on the first asking. I was so delighted at this that, as I signed the IOU with a swaggering air, I told him casually that the night before I had been keeping it up with some friends at the Hotel de Paris. We were giving a farewell party to a comrade, in fact, I might say a friend of my childhood, and you know, a desperate rake, fearfully spoilt. Of course, he belongs to a good family and has considerable means. A brilliant career. He is witty, charming, a regular Lovelace, you understand. We drank an extra half dozen and it went off all right. All this was uttered very easily, unconstrainedly, and complacently. On reaching home, I promptly wrote to Simonov. To this hour I am lost in admiration when I recall the truly gentlemanly, good-humored, candid tone of my letter, with tact and good breeding, and above all, entirely without superfluous words, I blamed myself for all that had happened. I defended myself, if I really may be allowed to defend myself, by alleging that, being utterly unaccustomed to wine, I had been intoxicated with the first glass, which I said I had drunk before they arrived, while I was waiting for them at the Hotel de Paris between 5 and 6 o'clock. I begged Simonov's pardon especially. I asked him to convey my explanations to all the others, especially to Zverkov, whom I seem to remember, as though in a dream, I had insulted. I added that I would have called upon all of them myself, but my head ached, and besides I had not the face to. I was particularly pleased with a certain lightness, almost carelessness, strictly within the bounds of politeness, however, which was apparent in my style, and, better than any possible arguments, gave them at once to understand that I took rather an independent view of all that unpleasantness last night, that I was by no means so utterly crushed as you, my friends, probably imagine, but on the contrary looked upon it as a gentleman serenely respecting himself should look upon it. On a young hero's past no censure is cast. There is actually an aristocratic playfulness about it, I thought admiringly, as I read over the letter, and it's all because I am an intellectual and cultivated man. Another man in my place would not have known how to extricate himself, but here I have got out of it and am as jolly as ever again, and all because I am a cultivated and educated man of our day. And indeed, perhaps, everything was due to the wine yesterday. No, it was not the wine. I did not drink anything at all between 5 and 6 when I was waiting for them. I had lied to Simonov. I had lied shamelessly. And indeed I wasn't ashamed now. Hang it all, though. The great thing was that I was rid of it. I put 6 rubles in the letter, sealed it up, and asked Apollon to take it to Simonov. When he learned that there was money in the letter, Apollon became more respectful and agreed to take it. Towards evening I went out for a walk. My head was still aching and giddy after yesterday. But as evening came on and the twilight grew denser, my impressions, and following them my thoughts, grew more and more different and confused. Something was not dead within me. In the depths of my heart and conscience it would not die, and it showed itself in acute depression. For the most part I jostled my way through the most crowded business streets. Along Myeshchansky Street, along Sadovy Street, and in Yusupov Garden. I always liked particularly sauntering along these streets in the dusk, just when there were crowds of working people of all sorts going home from their daily work, with faces looking cross with anxiety. What I liked was just that cheap bustle, that bare prose. On this occasion the jostling of the streets irritated me more than ever. I could not make out what was wrong with me. I could not find the clue. Something seemed rising up continually in my soul, painfully, and refusing to be appeased. I returned home completely upset. It was just as though some crime were lying on my conscience. The thought that Liza was coming worried me continually. It seemed queer to me that of all my recollections of yesterday, this tormented me, as it were, especially, as it were, quite separately. Everything else I had quite succeeded in forgetting by the evening. I dismissed it all and was still perfectly satisfied with my letter to Simonov. But on this point, I was not satisfied at all. It was as though I were worried only by Liza. "What if she comes?" I thought incessantly. "Well, it doesn't matter. Let her come." It's horrid that she should see, for instance, how I live. Yesterday I seemed such a hero to her, while now... It's horrid, though, that I have let myself go so. The room looks like a beggar's, and I brought myself to go out to dinner in such a suit, and my American leather sofa with the stuffing sticking out, my dressing gown which will not cover me, such tatters. She will see all this. She will see Apollon. That beast is certain to insult her. He will fasten upon her in order to be rude to me, and I, of course, shall be panic-stricken as usual. I shall begin bowing and scraping before her and pulling my dressing gown around me. I shall begin smiling, telling lies. Oh, the beastliness! And it isn't the beastliness of it that matters most. There is something more important, more loathsome, viler. Yes, viler. And to put on that dishonest, lying mask again. When I reached that thought, I fired up all at once. Why dishonest? How dishonest? I was speaking sincerely last night. I remember there was real feeling in me, too. What I wanted was to excite an honorable feeling in her. Her crying was a good thing. It will have a good effect. Yet I could not feel at ease. All that evening, even when I had come back home, even after 9 o'clock, when I calculated that Liza could not possibly come, and what was worse, she came back to my mind always in the same position. One moment, out of all that had happened last night, stood vividly before my imagination. The moment when I struck a match and saw her pale, distorted face with its look of torture. And what a pitiful, what an unnatural, what a distorted smile she had at that moment. But I did not know then that 15 years later I should still, in my imagination, see Liza always, with the pitiful, distorted, inappropriate smile which was on her face at that minute. Next day I was ready again to look upon it all as nonsense, due to overexcited nerves, and above all, as exaggerated. I was always conscious of that weak point of mine, and sometimes very much afraid of it. I exaggerate everything. That is where I go wrong, I repeated to myself every hour. But, however, Lisa will likely come all the same, was the refrain with which all my reflections ended. I was so uneasy that I sometimes flew into a fury. She'll come. She is certain to come, I cried, running about the room. If not today, she will come tomorrow. She'll find me out. The damnable romanticism of these pure hearts. Oh, the vileness, oh, the silliness, oh, the stupidity of these wretched, sentimental souls. Why? How fail to understand? How could one fail to understand? But at this point I stopped short, and in great confusion indeed. And how few words, I thought, in passing, were needed. How little of the idyllic, and affectedly, bookishly, artificially idyllic, too, had sufficed to turn a whole human life at once according to my will. That's virginity, to be sure, freshness of soil. At times, a thought occurred to me to go to her, to tell her all, and beg her not to come to me. But this thought stirred, crushed that damned Lisa if she had chanced to be near me at the time. I should have insulted her, have spat at her, have turned her out, have struck her. One day passed, however, another, and another. She did not come, and I began to grow calmer. I felt particularly bold and cheerful after 9 o'clock. I even sometimes began dreaming, and rather sweetly. I, for instance, became the salvation of Lisa, simply through her coming to me and my talking to her. I develop her, educate her. Finally, I notice that she loves me passionately. I pretend not to understand. I don't know, however, why I pretend, just for effect, perhaps. At last, all confusion transfigured, trembling and sobbing, she flings herself at my feet and says that I am her savior and that she loves me better than anything in the world. I am amazed. But, Lisa, I say, can you imagine that I have not noticed your love? I saw it all, I divined it, but I did not dare to approach you first, because I had an influence over you and was afraid that you would force yourself from gratitude to respond to my love, would try to rouse in your heart a feeling which was perhaps absent, and I did not wish that, because it would be tyranny, it would be indelicate. In short, I launch off at that point into European, inexplicably lofty subtleties a la George Sand. But now you are mine. You are my creation. You are pure. You are good. You are my noble wife. Into my house come bold and free, its rightful mistress there to be. Then we begin living together, go abroad, and so on, and so on. In fact, in the end, it seemed vulgar to me myself, and I began putting out my tongue at myself. Besides, they won't let her out. The hussy, I thought. They don't let them go out very readily, especially in the evening. For some reason I fancied she would come in the evening, and at 7 o'clock precisely. Though she did say she was not altogether a slave there yet and had certain rights, so, damn it all, she will come. She's sure to come. It was a good thing, in fact, that Apollon distracted my attention at that time by his rudeness. He drove me beyond all patience. He was the bane of my life, the curse laid upon me by Providence. We had been squabbling continually for years, and I hated him. My God, how I hated him! I believe I had never hated anyone in my life as I hated him, especially at some moments. He was an elderly, dignified man who worked part of his time as a tailor. But for some reason, he despised me beyond all measure and looked down upon me insufferably. Though, indeed, he looked down upon everyone. Simply to glance at that flaxen, smoothly brushed head, at the tuft of hair he combed up on his forehead and oiled with sunflower oil, at that dignified mouth compressed into the shape of the letter V, made one feel one was confronting a man who never doubted of himself. He was a pedant, to the most extreme point, the greatest pedant I had met on earth, and with that had a vanity only befitting Alexander of Macedon. He was in love with every button on his coat, every nail on his fingers, absolutely in love with them, and he looked it. In his behavior to me, he was a perfect tyrant. He spoke very little to me, and if he chanced to glance at me, he gave me a firm, majestical, self-confident, and invariably ironical look that drove me sometimes to fury. He did his work with the air of doing me the greatest favor, though he did scarcely anything for me, and did not, indeed, consider himself bound to do anything. There could be no doubt that he looked upon me as the greatest fool on earth, and that he did not get rid of me was simply that he could get wages from me every month. He consented to do nothing for me for 7 rubles a month. Many sins should be forgiven me for what I suffered from him. My hatred reached such a point that sometimes his very step almost threw me into convulsions. What I loathed particularly was his lisp. His tongue must have been a little too long or something of that sort, for he continually lisped and seemed to be very proud of it, imagining that it greatly added to his dignity. He spoke in a slow, measured tone, with his hands behind his back, and his eyes fixed on the ground. He maddened me particularly when he read aloud the Psalms to himself behind his partition. Many a battle I waged over that reading. But he was awfully fond of reading aloud in the evenings in a slow, even, sing-song voice, as though over the dead. It is interesting that that is how he has ended. He hires himself out to read the Psalms over the dead, and at the same time he kills rats and makes blacking. But at that time I could not get rid of him. It was as though he were chemically combined with my existence. Besides, nothing would have induced him to consent to leave me. I could not live in furnished lodgings. My lodging was my private solitude, my shell, my cave, in which I concealed myself from all mankind. And Apollon seemed to me, for some reason, an integral part of that flat, and for 7 years I could not turn him away. To be 2 or 3 days behind with his wages, for instance, was impossible. He would have made such a fuss, I should not have known where to hide my head. But I was so exasperated with everyone during those days that I made up my mind for some reason and with some object to punish Apollon and not to pay him for a fortnight the wages that were owing him. I had for a long time, for the last 2 years, been intending to do this simply in order to teach him not to give himself airs with me and to show him that if I liked I could withhold his wages. I proposed to say nothing to him about it, and was purposely silent, indeed, in order to score off his pride and force him to be the first to speak of his wages. Then I would take the 7 rubles out of a drawer, show him I have the money put aside on purpose, but that I won't. I won't. I simply won't pay him his wages. I won't. Just because that is what I wish, because I am master, and it is for me to decide, because he has been disrespectful, because he has been rude, but if he were to ask respectfully, I might be softened and give it to him. Otherwise, he might wait another fortnight, another 3 weeks, a whole month. But angry as I was, yet he got the better of me. I could not hold out for 4 days. He began as he always did begin in such cases, for there had been such cases already. There had been attempts, and it may be observed, I knew all this beforehand. I knew his nasty tactics by heart. He would begin by fixing upon me an exceedingly severe stare, keeping it up for several minutes at a time, particularly on meeting me or seeing me out of the house. If I held out and pretended not to notice these stares, he would, still in silence, proceed to further tortures. All at once, apropos of nothing, he would walk softly and smoothly into my room when I was pacing up and down or reading, stand at the door, one hand behind his back, and 1 foot behind the other, and fix upon me a stare more than severe, utterly contemptuous. If I suddenly asked him what he wanted, he would make no answer, but continue staring at me persistently for some seconds. Then, with a peculiar compression of his lips and a most significant air, deliberately turn round and deliberately go back to his room. 2 hours later he would come out again and again present himself before me in the same way. It had happened that in my fury I did not even ask him what he wanted, but simply raised my head sharply and imperiously and began staring back at him. So we stared at one another for 2 minutes. At last he turned with deliberation and dignity and went back again for 2 hours. If I were still not brought to reason by all this, but persisted in my revolt, he would suddenly begin sighing while he looked at me, long, deep sighs as though measuring by them the depths of my moral degradation, and of course it ended at last by his triumphing completely. I raged and shouted, but still was forced to do what he wanted. This time the usual staring maneuvers had scarcely begun when I lost my temper and flew at him in a fury. I was irritated beyond endurance apart from him. "Stay!" I cried, in a frenzy, as he was slowly and silently turning, with one hand behind his back, to go to his room. "Stay! Come back! Come back, I tell you!" And I must have bawled so unnaturally that he turned round and even looked at me with some wonder. However, he persisted in saying nothing, and that infuriated me. "How dare you come and look at me like that without being sent for? Answer!" After looking at me calmly for half a minute, he began turning round again. "Stay!" I roared, running up to him. "Don't stir. There. Answer now. What did you come in to look at?" "If you have any order to give me, it's my duty to carry it out," he answered, after another silent pause, with a slow, measured lisp, raising his eyebrows and calmly twisting his head from one side to another, all this with exasperating composure. "That's not what I'm asking you about, you torturer," I shouted, turning crimson with anger. "I'll tell you why you came here myself. You see, I don't give you your wages. You are so proud you don't want to bow down and ask for it, and so you come to punish me with your stupid stares, to worry me. And you have no suspicion how stupid it is. Stupid, 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 stupid!" He would have turned round again without a word, but I seized him. "Listen," I shouted to him. "Here's the money. Do you see? Here it is." I took it out of the table drawer. "Here's the 7 rubles, complete. But you are not going to have it. You are not going to have it until you come respectfully with bowed head to beg my pardon. Do you hear?" "That cannot be," he answered, with the most unnatural self-confidence. "It shall be so," I said. "I give you my word of honor, it shall be." "And there's nothing for me to beg your pardon for," he went on, as though he had not noticed my exclamations at all. "Why, besides, you called me a torturer, for which I can summon you at the police station at any time for insulting behavior." "Go summon me," I roared. "Go at once, this very minute, this very second. You are a torturer, all the same, a torturer." But he merely looked at me, then turned, and regardless of my loud calls to him, he walked to his room with an even step and without looking round. "If it had not been for Liza, nothing of this would have happened," I decided inwardly. Then, after waiting a minute, I went myself behind his screen with a dignified and solemn air, though my heart was beating slowly and violently. "Apollon," I said quietly and emphatically, though I was breathless, "go at once, without a minute's delay, and fetch the police officer." He had meanwhile settled himself at his table, put on his spectacles, and taken up some sewing. But hearing my order, he burst into a guffaw. "At once! Go this minute! Go on, or else you can't imagine what will happen." "You are certainly out of your mind," he observed, without even raising his head, lisping as deliberately as ever and threading his needle. "Whoever heard of a man sending for the police against himself? And as for being frightened, you are upsetting yourself about nothing, for nothing will come of it." "Go!" I shrieked. Clutching him by the shoulder, I felt I could strike him in a minute. But I did not notice the door from the passage softly and slowly open at that instant, and a figure come in, stop short, and begin staring at us in perplexity. I glanced, nearly swooned with shame, and rushed back to my room. There, clutching at my hair with both hands, I leaned my head against the wall and stood motionless in that position. 2 minutes later, I heard Apollon's deliberate footsteps. "There is some woman asking for you," he said, looking at me with peculiar severity. Then he stood aside and let in Liza. he would not go away, but stared at us sarcastically. "Go away! Go away!" I commanded in desperation. At that moment, my clock began whirring and wheezing, and struck 7. End of chapter 8.